Blog Talk Radio.
Singing this evening. Good evening and welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E. This is Miss E, also known as the Heart Lady, talking to you from Northern California on Tuesday, February 9th, 2011. And today we have an awesome guest. Not that all of our guests aren't awesome, but this young man is actually someone I've not met in person, but his reputation precedes him, and I've heard of him, and I have a real interesting story to share about how this connection was facilitated. And our guest is Mr. Chris Cozzirol, and I think he might be trying to get to the phone. He sent me a note about 15 minutes ago asking, was this the actual time? However, I'm going to read to you a little bit about Mr. Chris Cozzirol and his mission as well as his life is something that is very, very dear to my heart. And Mr. Cozzirol is a survivor of child abuse, foster care, homelessness, and incarceration. He is the founder of the Hip Hop Project. From executive producers Bruce Willis and Queen Latifah, the Hip Hop Project is the compelling documentary of Kazi, a formerly homeless teenager who inspires a group of New York City teens to transform their lives into powerful works of art, using his hip hop as a vehicle for self-development and discovery. Kazi's mission is to use the arts to empower the voice of young people. This young man is the author of not only, you know, the subject of the movie script Hip Hop Project, he's the author of a forthcoming book entitled All Things Are Possible. And as you listen to him and as you just look at some of the things that he has done and that he is doing, and I have begun to follow him on Facebook, and I'm just amazed at the energy that he has and that he utilizes and to making a positive difference in not only his life, but in the lives of other young people and old people alike. Because I know he's posted some things that have caused me to say, as Arsenio Hall used to say, he puts questions out, and it shows to me that he has a mind of a continuous learning and learning to make a change, not just to have the knowledge, but to implement that change as well. So, yet again, we have our chat room open. Let me see who's in our chat room. I know we saw our co-host from last week on. Dan Smith is in the chat room. And there's a guest that's not identified. And let's see what's going on with our switchboard. Okay, we're still waiting for Chris. Come on, Chris. So if you had a chance to take a look at the announcement, I thought it was interesting. Three of the pictures that I captured from Chris's photos in his profile all represent a different side of him. And I like the fact that all of them are truly him. You can just feel his warmth. We can feel his energy, but you can also see his centeredness. And I think a lot of times our young people, they feel like in order to be successful, they have to fit one image or the other. And my belief is that you can be, you know, all that you can be. You can be all who you can be. You see the serious businessman side of him. You also see the playful, energetic side of him, and you see that part that is grounded. And I believe we actually have Chris on the line. Let me see.
Hello, hello.
Hello, are you there? Is Chris?
Yeah, this is me. This is me. How you feeling?
I'm doing great. I'm relieved that you're on the line.
Yeah, yes, sir.
I was going
on.
New York
City is always so. Huh?
I know it is, and knowing you, regardless of where you are, there will always be something. Did you get to hear anything that I said about you prior to your coming on?
No, but I'm sure it's all good. So thank you in advance for before I hear the show back. But any compliments you gave, I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I was just saying, you know, by the fact I read a little bit of your bio, which I usually don't like to read. I like to let that come out in the conversation, but I needed to give the people a sense. And I was saying to them that the series of events that led me to you are an interesting story, which will unfold as I talk to you. But I was talking about the photos that I placed to announce this call, how each of them gives a different side of you that are a part of your whole that just tickles me pink, because I see that energetic, playful side of you. I see that businessman in you, and I see that part of you that is focused and just centered. And I just admire that. And even just from your messages and listening to your voicemail, I love the fact that you're focused. You're dependent on doing what you're doing, but living all that you can live.
No, indeed. I always say, you know, tomorrow is not promised, so you got to make history today, you know. So I don't never know when the day comes that the Creator is going to say, all right, Kazi, time for you to go. So I have to work feverishly to make all these ideas in my head happen.
Yes. So, you are doing that. And as I even just look at, you know, your blogs, your interests, all of the different projects you have going on, I'm proud of you. I don't like this United Way say, I don't know you, but I love you. It's like, I don't know you, but I'm proud of you. In some degree, I feel like I know you. So first, let's start off, because one of the aspects of your life has a very special place in my heart. I primarily work with foster and adoptive youth and former foster youth. So I understand that in your beginnings, that was part of your story. So will you tell our listeners a little bit about that as we work out towards what you're doing today?
I was born and raised in a small island. Do you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. I do hear some background noise, but I can hear you fine.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I was born and raised in Nassau, Bahamas. And my mother was a Jamaican immigrant living there on the island, and she, left me because, you know, she didn't have the finances to take care of me, and she left me at 6 months with a friend. That living situation began to be an abusive situation, and the child welfare agency of the Bahamas took me out of that home and placed me into the children's emergency hostel, which is a home for kids that are unwanted. And I lived there for a few years, and periodically different volunteers would come and spend time with us and teach us how to read and so on and so forth. And I met a social worker by the name of Catherine Brown, who was employed there, who was a retired nurse and wanted to do something with her time, as well as try to find a kid to adopt, particularly a girl, because she had already adopted another girl while she was in school in Canada, nursing school in Canada. She adopted a young Indian girl. But she said it was something about me when she saw me that made her want to say, you know, I want to take this kid home, and we spend weekends together, and eventually she asked me to come live with her, and I was ecstatic to do so. I was very much an introverted kid at the time because of the abuse of the home that I lived in. And I always say that Catherine Brown tried to give me heaven, but I gave her hell. And the whole family got hell from me because, I guess I was testing the love. I didn't understand how could strangers love me and my own mother give me away. And I really put a strain on the family, and it came to a point that I did something that broke the camel's back when I was 14 years old, and the family said either he goes or we go, and my mother, foster mother, and my grandmother, they were willing to say, you know, he's a special kid, and we feel as if, you know, we're willing to ride with him and understand why he acts the way that he does, you know? So, long story short, I decided to leave because I didn't want to be around the animosity from everybody else in the family. We had a pretty big family down there, so I decided to go back to an orphanage called the Ranfurly Home for Children, which is another home, but it's for kids that are much older. And once I stayed in the Ranfurly Home, I got in trouble there too, all the boys in my room, particularly because when you reach the age of a specific age of the teens, preteens and above, you're not a commodity, so to speak, in the foster care world. So our room was just the kids that, you know, we probably felt very bad internally that nobody wanted us. And, you know, now I could look back and say that, but at the time we were just always in trouble. So we got in trouble and we had to leave. It was five of us, and I went to a reform school. At the reform school, I met a psychiatrist who was the family psychiatrist when I was giving the family trouble. So he remembered me, and he told me that my biological mother came looking for me when I was 10 years old, and the courts decided that I should not go with her. And I was like, really? So he and I wrote a letter to the American Embassy, and they tracked down my biological mother, and she sent me a plane ticket to come to America when I was 14 and a half. And I came here to America in the early 90s. And while the reunion was tumultuous, it was a little crazy. When guilt meets animosity and the two doesn't have the skills to communicate and no intermediate to kind of manage the conversation, is just not a good mixture. She kicked me out, and I had to go to live homeless in the streets. I would sleep on a train. I would sleep wherever I laid my head was my home. And I stumbled across a teaching artist who would work with kids who had tough situations in the community, and she taught us how to use arts and media to get out what was going on internally. And once we did that, we had a lot of feedback, and people really appreciated what we had to say. And it was just an outlet for kids that, you know, could be or were doing bad things. Because at the same time, while I was doing these positive things like performing my music and perform in this urban theater company started by Elaine Robeson called Tomorrow's Future, I was also involved in extracurricular, you know, street pharmaceutical entrepreneurial activities, if you follow my drift. And,
reframing.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, the devil find work for idle hands, and I had to do it out of necessity and just survival. And like many other people who are doing negative things, sometimes they are – I'm sorry, Evelyn, you were about to say something?
No, but finish your sentence, because I want to slow down a little bit and go back, because you hit on some real important things that I want people in the village to capture. But you were saying people do things to survive. Okay.
Yeah, people do things to survive, and I just – yeah, that was it.
Okay. I wanted to go back because you say some very important things, because in my work – as a therapist, with foster families and adoptive families, and having been a foster and adoptive parent myself, my whole thing is to get people to never give up. Last week, or the last call we did was about placement disruptions. What are the things, when should a parent give up, a caregiver should give up, what is the final line, and people needing to know what their limits are. And I just experienced a disruption from one of the families I worked with that I felt didn't have to disrupt, and especially the way that it did. So looking back, you're saying, okay, I did something that really broke the camel's back, and you know that you gave them hell. But in the process of that, the way that that ending came, how were you feeling about the placement disrupting? Because you knew that there was some caring for you, but at the same time, there was something else going on.
At the time, I just cared more about my foster mother, because I was coming into the realization that I just do bad things, you know, and not necessarily bad. I'm just curious, you know. I'm curious, and I'm like, I would sneak out of my house late at night to go out and dance. I wanted to dance and perform. So, you know, in the Bahamas, there's not an age range on going to, like, clubs. And so I had a rap group and a performance group, and I wanted to just go out and do that. So it was a very strict household. So, you know, they make jokes about it now. Say, if Christopher put his mind to something, he's going to make it happen by any means necessary. So you might as well not tell him no. You just rather support him in whatever his vision is. So,
Was that what broke the straw that broke the camel's back? Because one of the people in our chat wanted to know what happened.
No, what I did, I basically, I took my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt. Those were the three musketeers. I was with them all the time. This is probably why I'm so sensitive to women's issues and stuff like that, because I was always with these three older women. You know, my mother was like grandmother age. My grandmother was, you know, so anyway, I got very old school values from those three ladies. But anyway, they went on a cruise, and I took my mother's car, and I lived in like a upper middle class area in the Bahamas, and my grandmother lived like in the ghetto. And I took my mother's car from my house to my grandmother's house, and then I got all of my friends, and we had a party at my grandmother's house because they was out of town. At the time,
okay.
I might have been 13 years. I was 13 years old at the time. So it was
okay.
A lot. Like, you know, I basically stole my mother's car and drove all of my friends around and had a party in my grandmother's house. And nobody knew. My brother just happened to wanted to ask me something. And when he went to check the bed, he saw that I made up the bed. And so then he tried to figure out where I was at and found the keys. And so it was just a culmination of always something with Christopher, and now he does this.
Okay.
The thing that my mother saw, that it took a certain level of thinking to do some of the things that I did. So her whole thing was just trying to get me to just use that mind in a different way, you know? And you know, when I look back, she would always say that Christopher is like a genius, you know, and she would say these things, and she would tell the school teachers that he just thinks differently. And, you know, she was patient and kind, but I just saw the way that people treated me. It was almost like I was trying to prove them right. It was trying to prove, man, actually, I was trying to prove myself right, that I'm not worthy to be loved. So I want to do, I'm going to do all of the things that's going to show you guys, to pull out what I think about myself deep down inside, if that makes sense, you know?
Makes a lot of sense.
I don't know if it makes
sense,
but it's my truth, you know?
I was going to ask you, did you feel that you were undeserving of her love, so you would rather do the self-fulfilling prophecy of what other people saw of you? Because she saw something in say, you know, well, no, that ain't right. Everybody else is right. You got it wrong. I don't deserve this. Wow.
Right, you know, because she said.
Go ahead.
No, she said the question that was constant. I recently took my lady down there to meet her, and she told my lady that Christopher always asked, how could
these strangers love me and my mother gave me away.
Mm. Wow. It reminds me of a statement that Les Brown always says. He also being an adoptee, he said, God took me out of my biological mother's womb and placed me in my adoptive mother's heart. And I just that statement because I believe that that is the case. And even with my parenting abilities, you know, my parenting experiences, I should say, I sometimes pick up on that. And now going through just a real crazy experience with my 28-year-old right now who came to me when he was 7, you know, it just tears my heart out. But I realize that that's also still a part of that. My own mother gave me away. Why should you give me, you know, why should you continue to love me when I treat you like this? And it is hard. And my whole message to the village, and you're just a prime example, my thing is for never, ever give up. And I want people to recognize the gifts. I love that your mom was able to see those gifts because I see it all the time. I see the potential in our young people, and I love seeing them use it positively, but they throw their gifts away. But if we could just hold on and be there, which brings me to another question, is who believed in you and gave you hope, even when you made bad choices? Hello? Okay. We may have lost him. Let me take a look at the switchboard.
Hello, hello, hello.
Oh,
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Okay, you hear me. No, I was going to say that it was definitely Catherine Brown, my biological mother, because as I look back, and people always ask me, like, when I
your biological mother or your foster mother, your adoptive mother?
I'm sorry. I'm a foster mother. Thank you for catching that. But yeah, when I do a lot of tours and performances around, I get that question a lot. You know, why do I do the work that I do? And I think, like, when I think of this woman who was, her children were old, were out of college and ready to, you know, start their own family. So she didn't need to do this. She always said, I wanted to give to somebody in my passing, meaning as I passed through this world, I wanted to do something for somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And I always remembered that. She would say that when I was young, and I didn't really understand, but I understand now. And it's because of her that I do the work that I do. And though I touch thousands of people every day in my work, that just goes to the testament that one person doing for somebody else that may not be their blood relative, like, look what that could do. You could touch the heart of somebody that could change the world. It's a ripple effect. A lot of times we don't see that if we could just touch one person. So I would definitely say her. She's a huge part. But the second person is Elaine Robeson, who was the teaching artist in the community of Crown Heights in Brooklyn, who I stumbled upon this theater group after I was beat. I was in a fight with some kids, and these same bad kids ended up saying, yo, we're going to rehearsal. I went to rehearsal, and I met this woman named Elaine Robeson, and she basically was just such a sweet soul, and she was willing to work with the toughest, roughest kids in the community. And many of us have went on to, you know, be successful in the music and entertainment, but just successful people in taking care of our families and being able to make a living legally in a very tough area like Crown Heights. And she, I would say all of the stuff that I'm doing, music and art, I really learned from her. She really helped nurture my talent here when I came to America. And then the third person is a guy by the name of Scott Rosenberg, who was actually my high school teacher, and he was, you know, he's from a different tax bracket, and I didn't know that when I first met him, but he's just such a cool guy, and, you know, older Jewish guy, and he liked hip-hop, I like hip-hop, and he's the one that really inspired me to start using hip-hop to impact people, and he gave me the resources and the backing to make it happen.
Wow. And so there you have the core of your village.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's what I want people to realize. I want the, and when I do these calls, when I do our television program, when I speak, my whole thing is to let people know that there is something valuable in all of our children. They're all our children, and to not give up because it doesn't appear to, you don't get instant gratification just because you do something or you reach out, and that we will get hurt sometimes in the process, but it's worth it, you know, and it's your prime example. And there's so many around the world, unfortunately, it's not the young people like you who actually get the most publicity. It's the all the things that are going wrong, and people are discouraged. And I want to encourage people to invest the time, invest the energy, but I also want to give a message to the young people who might be where you were at that point. Now, you mentioned that you met Mr. Rosenberg, and he was from a different life tax bracket, and you weren't aware of that. But at that point, how did you envision your adult life being?
To be honest, I didn't really have a, well, let me not say that. I didn't have a vision. I like most kids, what is promoted to you is music or entertainment or sports. So I'm athletic. I did martial arts for most of my life. I still do martial arts, but I was more, I rap. I did music, so I always had this vision of trying to be like, you know, Russell Simmons on the business side and like Jay-Z. Matter of fact, not even Jay-Z, LL Cool J on the music side. But other than that, I was always reactive, like most kids. We're just trying to survive, and we don't have a vision for the future, partly because all we see around us is just poverty, is just drugs, is, you know, violence. So you don't have a vision. Only vision you have is what you see on TV. But, you know, that's something that's like in your mind, but you don't have an actual vision or a plan or a map to make that happen. So I didn't really think about being an adult. I was just trying to survive.
From day to day, and giving purpose to living. And that's the other part of us giving our young people a vision, expanding their vision of what life has to offer. And one of our listeners has a program called Bigger Than Your Block. And I love it because people don't realize that the world really is bigger than our block, bigger than our hood, bigger than our community, bigger than our city. You know, I live in Northern California, and I live probably about 40 miles from, if not even that far, 30 miles maybe from San Francisco, and there are people who've never even been across the San Francisco Bridge. And so if you don't see anything, you have nothing to aspire to. And so it's important that we're shown. So what did they show you? They helped you to find, to tap into the gift. What was your first view of knowing, wow, this is available to me?
Indeed.
Indeed. I would say I'm very blessed. And I don't know what to say, but I'm just blessed.
Right. But what was the first thing that you, the first time you saw something that was outside of your normal view that you could see? Oh, I could see myself doing that. I could see myself there.
I mean, first of all, just coming to America is one, because I'm from a little island. Called Nassau in the Bahamas. And so most of the dreams that you have, you just it didn't seem attainable because you there was no way to get off of this island, you know. So that was one. And then when I came to America, I like most folks, I was in my community, and all I saw was inside of my community. But Elaine Robeson, she would take us on a college tours. We would go to different colleges throughout the tri-state, throughout the eastern coast, and we would just try to we would just see things that were not our norm. I would say so. Those are the first things. I remember going to like a rocking horse ranch, which, you know, like it sounds simple if you live in that area, But coming from the inner city of Brooklyn, coming from the Bahamas, it was just to see horses and see nature when you're only surrounded by dilapidated buildings. And, you know, it was definitely a new thing.
Yes, yes. So, again, putting it out there and making it tangible, something that you can reach out and touch, that you can start to integrate and incorporate into your psyche to say, I could see me there. I could see me doing this. Yeah, and it's not like it's so far away. I like that. That is so important. Now I want to move on to your work that you're doing today. But one other question I want to ask you, because you mentioned the psychiatrist who saw you, that had worked with you and your mother. As a therapist, I always want to know, is my work, does it have any impact? And I've been in, you know, the field long enough to see the impact that it has had on some of my kids, and others I'll never know. What do you recall about the therapy, and was it at all useful for you?
I honestly don't know. I just did it, you know. I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's good because I what I do now, even with my music and a lot of that work, is that I am trying to help other people, other young people, and maybe being able to talk and work through all of my personal issues a lot was like a training. Because a lot of the intelligence I have discovered in myself has been organic. And I call myself an organic intellectual in that, you know, I have discovered some gifts. And I think the whole process of just being the whole process of that a psychiatrist take you through is an exploration in the self, and somebody who's particularly focused on walking you through your mind helps you discover things about yourself. And I don't think that we had enough. And I think that a psychiatrist or counseling or AA meetings or, you know, support circles are the only place that we actually take the time to have, you know, somebody help us probe our questions. So that's been helpful to me, I would say. And as I look at the work that I do now and the work that I just do, I'm very much like a psychiatrist. I have no formal training, but so I don't know if that's connected to what that I've been through. I don't actually know was it helpful, because one of the things a psychiatrist made me do was he gave me Ritalin, and when I all the stuff that I'm discovering now about genius is or the brilliance that is in with every human being is goes to show that a lot of the doctors, the clinical traditional clinical remedies are not always the best, because they may be suppressing or subduing something. And this is not for everybody, and but, you know, it may be suppressing and subduing something that's good. So they were giving me Ritalin. I had so much energy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted, and I just had so much ideas, but nobody taught me that these, until I met Scott Rosenberg, the guy I told you about earlier. Nobody ever taught me that when you have so much ideas running in your head, you have to be able to write them down and work them through. It shows that you are a visionary. But only thing that they knew was that we don't know, he won't sit still, because what has been tradition is to sit in a classroom for all those hours.
People learn in different ways. And to talk about the medicine issue with, you know, kids is a real big issue for me, because I figure for the most part, I would probably say, you know, probably less than 10% of the kids that are on medication really need it. I think a lot of the medication that is done with our kids is for the adults to try to learn how to handle them, because the kids are gifted. And that's what I call them. I said, these are our little geniuses. And so when I see kids that are full of energy and constantly going, it just tickles me on the inside. They might wear me out, but I love them. I appreciate it because I know that there's a God-given gift, and most of us have suppressed ours so much to conform to society's expectations. You know, I don't believe in a child being totally out of control, but I believe in us providing some guidance for that child and some place to put all that energy. You know, many times as adults, we're either just tired or just plain lazy. And I want people to embrace and help our young people to embrace their gifts. So I'm grateful that you got past that. And now, and I'm not saying that nobody needs medication, but I believe that the majority of people who are really don't. And so to exercise your gifts. So let's talk about, I want to talk more about Together Apart because this is February, and I'll tell you why I wanted to talk about that after I found out that you were doing it. But I want to talk a little bit about the Hip Hop Project. Tell me about the Hip Hop Project.
The Hip Hop Project was a program that I started when I graduated from high school that allowed, that got teens to write, produce, and market their own hip-hop album while they were mentored by music industry professionals on the creative and corporate sides of the music business. The album that they wrote, though, the catch was they had to write about a personal issue going on in their life. And so we would meet and talk about those issues and help them to develop that song into a great piece of art, and then they would go around and perform that with other kids. And then along the way, a lot of celebrities and public figures got involved. One particularly named Bruce Willis, he gave us a studio where we recorded the album, and he also invested with a group of others, including Queen Latifah, to create a feature-length documentary film chronicling the process of writing, producing, and marketing that hip-hop album with the kids. So in a nutshell, that is the Hip-Hop Project.
Okay. Now let me tell you how I was introduced to the Hip-Hop Project. I still have not seen it, but I will. And I call the young people that I've worked with and that I mentor and support my heart. So one of my hearts, a young man that I'm surprised I don't see him in the chat room, is Jaquin Skills. He always says, Miss E, you should connect with this person. You should connect with this person. He said, check him out. Check out Chris Kazi Roll. So I said, okay. I looked at your profile page and went on doing what I was doing. So I left and went on a speaking tour in London the year before last. So at the end of our speaking tour, a friend had a birthday party. We're at the Hilton and whatever area it was. I see this young black man. I didn't know if he was African-American or not, but I just love young people. So I just went to him and started messing with him. And so he said, you're from the States, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, I could tell I'm from New York. So he said, really? He said, yeah, I'm here doing a project, yada, yada, yada. So we exchanged cards. And I looked at it, and it said, LiveWire. So I said, okay. So when I come back home, I'm going through, and I'm looking at your profile, pictures, who do I see? LiveWire. So I sent him an email and said, okay, I just about saw a picture of you. Do you know Chris Kazi Roll? Didn't I just meet you in London last week? And he happened to have been online. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning there, midnight here. And he said, yeah, you did meet me. And we started this conversation. And then that's when he told me that, you know, he was involved in the Hip Hop Project.
Oh, wow.
So that was my initial connection with you. I thought that was just hilarious. You know, what are the chances?
Yeah, I call him Young Globetrotter because he's always all over the globe somewhere making, you know, performing. He's an amazing artist.
Wow. So. Now, so you met him. I guess that story is in the documentary as well, how the two of you met.
No, but he's, a little bit, you know, we only had 85 minutes, so we had to compress, truncate some of the story. But basically, he was, I met him through just a friend of a friend. Everybody in the community knew him as a rapper, and they said, you got to meet Kazi. And, you know, so a friend of a friend introduced us, and
That might have been in 2003 or 2004. And we're still very good friends. So, you know, he's a peer now, you know, he's grown. He's a powerful guy. His work ethic, you can't outwork me personally, but he comes very close. Hence his name, Livewire.
Yes, I can tell. I'm on his mailing list, and I can't read them fast enough. And so I told him, I said, you know, when you come to the area, when I get there, I will be there if I can keep up with you. So that's awesome, and I just love that energy, and I believe that people with like minds and like hearts will always connect. Your Together Apart program, because one of the things that really concerns me is the issue of, one, when you have a disjointed childhood where relationships come and go and there's really little attachment, or when the attachment happens that there's some, you know, the bond is broken because there's no closure, and it affects adult relationships. And one of the things I've wanted to do for our young people who are getting involved in some very deep relationships at very young ages is to do some work on developing healthy relationships. And I understand that that's what you're doing with Together Apart. Tell us about that. And this is being February for Valentine's Month.
Okay. What I'm doing is that I bring large groups of men and women together to have conversations about love and dating, love and relationships. And I developed a method to have difficult conversations. And so I may have a group of 200, but it's really to be an example of how a group of two can have conversations. But I think having it in a group, it allows us to find out best practices, to hear and see that we are not alone in some of the issues that we personally may be dealing with. Also, I believe that the time that we're in is a shift that's happening, or innovation is happening across all industry, including the institution of marriage and relationships, and partly because of the success of the women's liberation movement, where there are so many women who are, traditionally women were in relationships partly because they needed a man for survival, in a sense, because, you know, the man's role was to go out and get the bacon, and women were home having the babies and cooking it and taking care of home, traditionally. And the children that grew up seeing that, a lot of them found that their mother was not happy, or the father was cheating, or, you know, they just wanted more for themselves, more than what their mothers had. So they went on to college and you know, they became more successful. Hence, you see on Nightline did a whole special on why 42% of black women are not married. And, that's one aspect of a very dynamic problem. But it inspired me because I found that a lot of those women were saying they couldn't find their counterpart. And I think that men don't know how to be with some of those successful women. I think that some women think that these men are intimidated by them, or, you know, insecure, or some men are insecure and are beating up these, you know, it's just so much issues in relationships. But because of the change that is going on, like I said, with the success of liberation movement, the recession, the amount of black boys that are not graduating from school, so when by the time they're 25 years old and they meet a woman who's 25 who has degrees and has finished 4 years of college, it's kind of hard to have the traditional relationship. So all we can get now is the data from conversations. How does a man whose whole self-worth is based on having money and being more educated than this woman, he can't take care of her and he's not as well-read as her, how does he feel secure in that relationship? We don't have that data. We have never lived in a world like that. This is a whole new world. So the only way we're going to find that out is by actually talking to real people, or real people talking to each other. So that is the long version of me saying that I just know that we need to talk more. Also, there's a stigma within the African-American community around therapy.
You know, either we can't afford it or we just not going to go through it. That's not our thing. But, you know, there's a lady by the name of Dr. Joy Leary who has a book called Post-Traumatic Slavery Syndrome. You know, if the talent runs in our race, so does dysfunction. And we all need some therapy. You know, I recommend it. Me and my girlfriend right now, we're in therapy because we want to get married. And, you know, we're making sure that we work on ourselves constantly because there's layers and layers of stuff. And anyway, long story short, all of the work I'm doing with Together Apart that kind of focuses on the age range of 25 to 40 to create these innovative spaces where men and women can come and have open and honest dialogue and conversation around relationships is really focused on kids, because when relationships fail between men and women, it's always the kids that suffer. I'm a product of that. So I'm doing it because I believe that the Creator puts us through situations to give us a purpose for our life. So I believe that I went through some of the traumatic experiences that I went through because I was being prepped to have to do the work that I'm doing. You know, I can talk to kids who other people can't talk to because I've been there. I know how you feel inside. And so when somebody starts talking to you and you are detailing what they're feeling or what they're going through, they're like, hold up, how do you know all that? And most kids, I've said this as a foster kid, you don't understand. You don't understand.
Right.
You don't know what I've been through. You don't know what it is for your mother to just throw you away like garbage. You know what I mean? And so unless you've been through it, I'm not going to listen to you. So anyway, long story short, I am deeply committed to seeing happy, loving relationships. And I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and complain about what is wrong with the world. I'm going to do something about it, and Together Apart is what I'm doing to ensure that we have tools and resources to talk and heal and nurture our relationships, romantic relationships, for the purpose of making sure that the kids that are born from relationships grow up in a happy, healthy family. So at the root of that is the romantic relationship between men and women. So it's a little strategic, you know, it's strategic to reach kids through doing stuff for parents and, you know, starting.
That's the foundation.
It is the foundation. Indeed.
You can't build a house without a foundation.
Indeed.
So I appreciate somebody recognizing it's not about being reactive, it's about being proactive, and you start before the babies even get here. So you got it. got it. I just love your energy. I just love your energy and the fact that you act upon it. Something I said before you came on the call is that one of the things I've observed, you ask a lot of questions. So when you talk about, you know, the therapeutic process, the introspective process, it comes with questions asking of yourself and finding out what other people's perceptions are so that you can take those things and come to some conclusion yourself. Because if you never ask the questions, you never give it any thought, but you're acting on something that you're not even aware of. You know, when I ask people a question, I never thought about that. And my thinking is like, how could you not think about that? So I got, you know, it's just part of living, and some of us are not taught to ask questions, and that's part of our education system, how some of us are brought up in our cultures and subcultures are told, don't ask me no questions, just do as I say. Well, how do you learn like that? You know, and if you learn by example and somebody's not being an appropriate role model, where do they expect us to go? So you stepped outside of the box, and I commend you for that. I really do.
Thank you very much. I believe that if you teach people, it's particularly young people, how to ask questions and how to think critically, you don't have to hover over them. I think that is the single best skill to teach somebody is how to think for themselves and how to be self-aware and ask those questions of self and of other people. Just act. Just, you know, be a lifelong student of of life. So I think that if you can teach that to young people, and, you know, I wish I learned that earlier on, you know,
it'll just be easy to deal with situations. But because we're taught to just take in everything and do as we're told, especially in the West Indies, which is very much stricter than America, just, you know, it's hard to nurture that ability to just be self-guided, self-directed, and self-aware. And, you know, that's my goal, is to get people asking the right questions, you know, in their relationship. Because that's what it really all boils down to. You know, a lot of times we're not asking the right questions in relationships, particularly the relationship with ourselves.
Exactly. No, you got it. So you got it. You got it. You mind if I ask, how old are you?
Me, I'm 34.
Okay. You're a couple years older than my son. It's just so refreshing. You just don't know. It's just so refreshing. So when I get to meet you and you see this little lady with all teeth coming to grab you a hug, just get ready, because I'm going to squeeze real hard.
What state are you in?
I'm in California.
Okay, cool. What part?
Northern California, between San Francisco and Sacramento, or between Oakland and Sacramento.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I want to come up that side. I want to see these trees I heard about out there.
Oh, yeah, and the redwoods. Yeah, that's not far from me. So come up. We can ride through some tree trunks.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm putting together a tour right now just to travel to different states and tour schools, go to different schools and show my movie and do performances and a talk back with the audience. So I got to come on that side, because I want to see, because one part is also to just see the world. That's what I love about speaking, is just that I get to see so many places and just travel and, you know, see the world.
Well, let's talk, because I have a nonprofit organization. If we can, you know, pull together some funds to get you here and to get it going and make some contacts, because one of my goals is to give voice to our young people. Like when you talk about asking the questions and speaking, is to have young people to know that their story, their lives have value, and that when you share with somebody else, you know, I hear people saying, well, nobody wants to hear about my mess, you know, other words. And I said, but you don't know how it can help somebody by the fact that you are still here and that you're doing what you do, and that there's even much more. So that's one of the things that I want to do. And I try to do 2 events a year. However, sometimes just keeping the energy level up and the motivation of our young people when other people are not pushing can be somewhat disheartening at times, but I have to keep moving. And I just want you to know that you motivate me. What is it that keeps you motivated?
What keeps me motivated? I honestly don't know. But I know I would say constant inspiration. So, like, at my home, I play inspirational music. I watch inspirational movies. I always got a ton of T.D. Jakes and, you know, Joel Osteen, Les Brown, you know, Ayanna Van Zandt. I keep as much inspirational stimulus around me to keep me charged up. Because sometimes I get tired, I get weary. You know, I'm a human being. I'm not really a human being. I'm a superhero, but sometimes I'm half man, half amazing. So,
sometimes I
do get weary, but so I, these other superheroes, seeing them, you know, give that word, I call it word, sound, and power, you know, you listen to that and, you know, yeah, I'm charged up and ready to go.
I love it. And you're right. It has to be continuous. And it's interesting that you mentioned all my favorite people. How did you do that? All of my favorite people, because those are the people that I listen to as well. So as we get ready to wrap up our call, we have about 6 minutes left. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, what would you say to our youth who feel like they've been displaced, or they feel like there's nothing really, no purpose for them? What would you say to those who are struggling?
I would say, you know, even though this, what I'm about to say, is very hard to see at this time, I believe that you get information before you know you need it. Very much like the video games that we play. When you play a video game, they give you tools, they give you keys, they give you weapons, and then you reach a door, you reach an opponent, and then when you reach that door or opponent, it all makes sense. So I find that when you're going through the roughest, toughest situations in life, whoever or whatever created this thing called life is giving you a higher purpose for your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that higher purpose, you won't be ready for what that thing it is you have to do unless you go through a hard process. Now, the only challenge is that particular person that created this thing called life didn't have a conversation with you to tell you that I'm putting you all through all of this to prepare you for something great. And I really wish that somebody told me, because so many times I asked why me. But I did.
Mm-hmm.
Why me? Why me is a good question, actually. But you
mm-hmm.
can't do it in a pessimistic way. It is really like, all right, I've been called to do something great on this planet. Why me? What is it? Why? Not actually even why me. Why? Why have I been called? What is it that I'm being? Why do I have this family? Why did my family give me away? Why am I here in this orphanage? You know, if I seek to and look at right where I am and try to figure that out, I don't know the answer. But just by asking that question, the answer will reveal itself, because it is by a design.
It is by design that you are going through this. You're being put through a process to do something great in the world. The thing is, you just don't know what that thing is yet.
Yes, yes, wow. And I was going to ask you a last question, but before I ask you that, I wanted to know, what is your relationship to Ms. Brown and your biological mother, if they're still here?
My biological mother, she's not a very communicative person. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
Our calls may last about 5-10 minutes. But when I go over periodically on special occasions and hang out with her. And, you know, we're pretty cool, you know. She,
mm-hmm.
I go out Christmas, holidays, you know, stuff like that. She lives in Queens. I live in Brooklyn, which are pretty much right next to each other. My biological mother, my foster mother, I see her every year during the holidays. I go to the Bahamas. Every year or every other year, I go down there for the holidays, and I call her on main occasions and birthdays. She is my heart, and, you know, she taught me so much. So, and a lot of things that I do because of her.
Wonderful. And I just find it interesting that, you know, her name is Brown. Is it Catherine Brown? Yeah,
Catherine,
but she's
Brown,
Catherine,
yep.
Brown. So you're Catherine Brown's baby boy, and Les Brown is Mamie Brown's baby boy. And the last question I ask, what is the message that you would give to the adults who are working with our youth in the village when it seems hopeless?
To the adults, when you're working with the youth, just don't give up, you know, and don't take anything personally. Don't give up. Don't think anything personally, because the beautiful part about giving love, I think, is we mess up because we want the love back. It's like you
yeah.
want the person to act a certain way. I think, you know, just loving somebody, but also loving yourself, you know, just knowing your boundaries, and don't be abusive to yourself, but just give love and don't look for it in return. It'll come back. It may not come actually from the person you're giving the love to. It'll come out in other ways. But just focus on the love. Don't take it personally, anything people do to you. And actually, I always thought that, but it's in a book called The Four Agreements. It's a very powerful book that I think all parents should check out. That's what I would say. Don't take anything personally. Everybody's going to have their presence, their process. And it's there's nothing more powerful than love. And people can grow, people can heal, people can change. So know that by loving them, you never know when they will blossom. Some seeds are very deep into the earth, so it will not blossom right away. So don't seek to control the person that you're giving love to. Just give them love. Don't be abusive to yourself. Don't keep giving love and they just kick dirt on you. You have to draw your boundaries. But can continue to just give love and don't take anything personally if the person does not act the way that you expect them to act.
And I want to personally for that, because even though I teach that, I say that, being human, without myself to take it personally, and over the past 2 weeks has been a very difficult time for me with my own son. And so you're saying that just sort of sparked something within me. So I just thank you. It's just how you said it that made a difference. So as we're closing, we've got 1 minute left. But we have someone in our chat room said is glad to hear you speak. Kazi has been one of my inspirations to take our film from place to place to the next level. That's from Matt Anderson. And Ms. Shea says, why am I mad happy? He quoted Nas.
Yeah, yeah, half man, half amazing. Yeah.
Okay, so that's cool. So this has been awesome. I really look forward to speaking to you again. I love the way that you protect your time. Your message said, these are the times I talk to people when I'm not working on a project. So can you put me in our schedule so that we can have a real heart-to-heart talk to make something happen here on the West Coast?
No doubt. West Side, we'll talk later. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Right,
love you and God bless you.
All right. God bless you, too. Peace.
Bye-bye.
Did you like your dinner? You did? Not yet.
Not yet.
Huh?
Not
Hello? Right. Get a note first. Yeah.
Is it time for a new roof? If the roof on your house is old, weathered, or in need of help, you can save $500 if you call Sears Roofing right now. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Call right now and you can save $500. Sears licensed, fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears has a variety of shingles and tiles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. So call Sears Roofing and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
On that to have it taken away from them. But does, and it's very traumatic. And I talked to Evelyn about this, and it was interesting to me not being part of the foster care system. I have not been a foster parent, and I have not been a foster child. I am sort of a, I was going to say innocent bystander, but I really am an ignorant bystander. And what I mean by ignorant bystander is I have no knowledge of what's going on. And I hear these stories from Evelyn about these disruptions that happen to people, and it just absolutely amazes me, because it's not just one given area. It's not that they're leaving foster parents. And many times they're leaving the area. Many times they're leaving the school district. They're leaving behind friends without any ability to say goodbye. They are thrusting, sometimes if they're together, if they're siblings together, they're separated. They're thrust into another environment that they don't know. And often their social worker changes. The counselor that they've been working with, that they have built trust with, suddenly is not in the picture. And the system just believes that they can meet their needs by providing substitutes for all of these people. And it doesn't necessarily work that way. So I guess, as an ignorant bystander sitting on the sideline watching this, and as I learn these things, I am just amazed that there are children that grow into adults that have grown into healthy, well-adjusted adults. I can't imagine how that can happen when such a situation continues to happen in their lives.
Right.
And I lost my head. Okay.
And I'm only back for a moment. But what I'm going to do, there are some callers on the line here. I'm going to open up the line so that if there are others who have some input into the conversation, who have the personal experience, that they can engage in dialogue with people on that matter. So I'm going to open
up the
line.
Bless you, because I was running out of things.
Okay, I know that there are at least two others on the call. So if you would like to join in the conversation, and also if you're someone who is in the chat room, if you'll dial into the number 424-675-8303, your comments are greatly welcome. I'll be back when I can.
All right, thank you, Evelyn. Again, here we are, dealing with things as they happen. Is there anyone out there that would like to add to this conversation that has experienced this, or from either end of the spectrum, any end of the spectrum? Okay. Well, as I was saying, you know, as not being in the foster system, I grew up in a dysfunctional family. My parents were both alcoholics, so they were gone a lot. Emotionally, they were detached. Physically, they were there, but in a state of unconsciousness. Does that count? And I used to think it didn't count at all. And when Evelyn told me the stories about people being totally moved out of the house, the one thing I never experienced, I always knew where to go home. I always knew where my house was. I didn't necessarily know what was going to be happening in it. I didn't know if there would be a way to pass out or arguing or what would be going on. But I knew that I could go into my house and I could get past all that and I could go find my safe place. And when I think about with all the, you know, this, when the placement doesn't work, where does a foster child find a safe place? A place to just be able to go and to just be. And while they just want to maybe go and just be and just think about this, they're meeting new people, getting adjusted, wondering where they're going to be, and I really, if anyone is out there who's had any of this experience, sense. I really cannot put myself in that position. And as I said earlier, as an ignorant bystander, please get on the car and help educate me. Tell me what that's like.
Until you deal with the situation. there's still